Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. To say Robert Sabuda makes pop-up books is technically accurate, but it's certainly understated. Sabuda's 3D creations are as much impressive works of art and engineering as they are endearing children's stories. Today on the program, Robert Sabuda is with us to talk about his passion for pop-up. Robert Sabuda is a New York Times best-selling author and illustrator. He's got some 39 books, if
probably,
by my,
39 probably.
Books under his belt, including The Movable Mother Goose, The Night Before Christmas, The Wonderful Wizard of Oz. Robert Sabuda will be speaking about life as a paper engineer tonight, Thursday, September 27th at 7 o'clock here on Library Square. It's in the main City Library Auditorium, and a reception will follow on Level 4 in Special Collections. Robert Sabuda is in studio with me. Robert, good morning. Thanks so much for your time.
Good morning. Thank you for having me here.
Later on in the program, we'll turn to the centennial of a visit from a leader of the Baha'i faith. We'll hear about the coast-to-coast journey of Abdul Baha 100 years ago. But first, Robert Sabuda. What's your favorite Sabuda book, and why do you think people still love pop-up books? You can give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. I guess that's the first question I'll put to you, Robert. Why do people love pop-ups?
I think people love pop-ups because it's really sort of a magical experience between two pages in a book. I mean, we can read the stories and love the stories. We can see the illustrations and fall in love with those too, but there's a surprise, a magic moment when you turn a page and something three-dimensional literally leaps right out at you.
Mm. As I mentioned, the term pop-up seems wholly inadequate to describe what you do. I mean, how do you describe your work? Do you embrace pop-up, or is it something else?
No, I totally embrace it. I come from a building family. My father was a carpenter. My grandfather, my great-grandfather, they were all carpenters. So I love to build things, and I love to make things. And really, pop-up books are the ultimate make in a book. The little constructions, the folding, the gluing, the taping, the whole process of making it happen. I have to embrace it wholly, or I don't think I would make good books.
Were you drawn to pop-ups as a child?
I was when I was very young. I was a big reader. I tell people I don't remember my mother teaching us how to read. I just remember knowing how to read. So I was always a reader, and I always loved books. And pop-ups really sort of came, hit full force when I was a young boy. And when I saw my first pop-up book, I remember that it sort of changed my book experience. It never occurred to me that a book could be something other than two dimensions. It was fabulous.
What was the book?
That was a book called The Adventures of Super Pickle, believe it or not. It was about this pickle that dressed up like a superhero and would go around performing all these great deeds. And the story was fun, and the illustrations were kind of okay. But the fact that it was a little world, an actual little world in between the pages of the book, was just astounding. I'd never seen anything like that before.
Hmm. There are only a handful of people in the world who do what you do. Did you ever think you could build a career around pop-up books?
That is great. Sometimes I'm so amazingly naive, it's scary. I just assumed that things would sort of go my way. I worked really hard, and I thought I love children's books. I love illustrating children's books. I love making pop-up books. So surely the rest of the world will follow and accept me in love as well. And fortunately, that has really turned out to be true. But there's something good about that naivete of just doing and putting all your love and expression into something and then having it embraced. That's a wonderful, wonderful thing.
Mm. How long have you been in the biz?
I've been in the biz. I've been in children's publishing since 1988, so that's the bulk of my life. And actually, I guess I should say I don't really know how to do anything else. So if I didn't have children's books, I think life would be kind of tough for me. But it's a passion. It's a calling, I think, like being a teacher or being a nurse or something like that. Being in children's books is really a calling. It's an all-consuming part of my life.
Mm, I'm glad you don't know how to do anything else, because you've got some brilliant creations out there. We're speaking with Robert Sabuda. He's the New York Times bestselling author and illustrator of 39 books, and he'll be speaking tonight at the City Library, Thursday, September 27th at 7 o'clock. There is a reception that will follow. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. You mentioned that your father was a builder, that mm-hmm. you come from a family of builders. I understand you grew up in a Michigan farm town. And so while your parents weren't artists, but they certainly were creative in their own way, did they encourage your own artistic talents? And when did they notice that you had some remarkable abilities?
You know, I was very lucky at a time, and maybe it was because it was the 70s and my parents were slightly hippie-ish, but they fully supported what I wanted to do. And I think one of the things about growing up in a rural area and coming from a lower economic status is if your child shows any aptitude in anything, you're almost obligated as a parent to encourage that. And I should also mention that the same thing occurred with my teachers, because I've had my elementary school teachers come to some of my book signings or my events, and I've asked them, what was I like? Because I don't remember. What was I like as a student in your class? And they'll say, we knew you were going to be an artist right from the get-go, and it was really our obligation to support you. As long as you could do the rest of the schoolwork here, we let, you know, you could have free rein to do the kind of artwork that you wanted to. And that was really critical at a young age to know that this type of person that I was becoming was acceptable and okay, and I could make a future out of that.
So you felt empowered by the adults around you. What about the other kids? How did they react to you showing off? I mean, obviously, you were heads and shoulders, I'm sure, above anybody who had a crayon in their hand.
You know, an artist, it's really an interesting thing. Sometimes I can tell people look at me and they think, how is it even possible that you make this happen, which even goes back further to, like, how is it that you can even draw? Because most of the population in general on the planet are not able to really draw. And people look at me as if I have an answer for something like that. And I don't. I don't know why I can draw. I don't know the things that I can make. And so that fascination that I see in adults today was the same thing I saw in children when I was that age. And my classmates and my brother and my sister, they would just be amazed that you could pick up a pen or a crayon and, like, draw something and make that actually happen. So that support went all through all aspects of my life as a young person. And that's the advantage also of not coming from a family of, you know, really, I was the only person in my family to go to college. And it's easier when you don't come from a family of doctors and lawyers and, you know, investment bankers, where there are expectations for you to follow in these kinds of footsteps. And so the fact that I came from a simple background allowed my creative life to really flourish, because those expectations were small and artistic.
So you've been an artist forever. I mean, that's who you are. When did you start to experiment with paper, with cutting, with taping, creating these three-dimensional shapes?
Well, I've always been interested in a variety of technique. I discovered as I was becoming an adult artist that some artists find one medium that they prefer, whether they're welders or painters or printers, and they tend to stick with that because that's their passion and their heart. But I'm not really like that. I like to work. I was a printmaker. I draw well. I don't paint much. So I like to sort of try lots of different things. And when I started my career in children's book illustration, I was doing printmaking, and then I started to do paper mosaics and cut paper, torn paper. I just started to have a familiarity of passion with paper, the object in my hand and the tactile quality on my fingers. And I remember the excitement of not necessarily seeing new colors of paint, but seeing new pieces of paper, like huge handmade pieces of paper. And I thought, this is my life. There's something about the paper itself that I'm really falling in love with, the way a carpenter falls in love with wood and different types of wood. So it didn't surprise me that I started to explore different avenues of paper, and then eventually a three-dimensional world of paper, which is what pop-ups are.
You went to art school, the Pratt Institute of Art and Architecture in New York. How did that formal training influence your natural ability to draw and to create?
I was very nervous when I applied to go to Pratt Institute in New York, and foolishly, I only applied to one university. So anyone who's listening, don't only apply to one school, apply to a few schools. But I only applied to Pratt because I had an art teacher in my very small town. I grew up in a town of 800 people. And this art teacher, my high school art teacher, she said, you know, I'm going to get you ready to go to one of the best art schools in the nation. And I had never heard of Pratt before. And she really took me by the hand, and over the course of 4 years prepared me, got me ready to go to art school. And of course, being the country bumpkin, which I was, coming to New York City, which is the big city, I was very nervous about being at this really prestigious art school. But I have to tell you, I was completely ready. I was told she had prepared me. I was as prepared as the kids from California and Connecticut and everywhere else. But so I was ready to start this journey over 4 years that turned me from just a good artist into really an excellent artist by the time I was ready. When I graduated from Pratt and I decided that I wanted to involve my life in children's books, I was prepared by the time I was ready at that young age to go into publishing, and I did, you know, immediately afterwards. So I've been very lucky that that thread of education has been continuous and supported what I wanted to do as an artist.
This is becoming a testimonial for the teachers in your life.
It is. I mean, without teachers, we're nothing. I'm nothing.
What was your first pop-up project?
My first pop-up project was when I was very young. I was about 8, and I made a pop-up version of The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, which is my favorite story and my favorite movie. And I couldn't get the tornado to spin at the beginning of that book when I was a boy. And so I kind of abandoned that, as we all do as children. If I'm not good at it, I'm abandoning it. I continued to become an artist. But I didn't really start to explore pop-ups as an adult until I got to college. Pratt is very good on trying a variety of different things and techniques, and I began to do a little bit of three-dimensional work. But I didn't start to do pop-ups professionally until about 1992, 1993, when I decided I'm going to start to really explore this in three dimensions and see if I can get a book published. And so Christmas Alphabet was published in 1994, which was my first pop-up book.
I mean, what did your teachers make of you, though? I mean, it's not the traditional route. I'm going to make a pop-up book. I mean, usually you would go into sculpting or into oil paints.
Well, I think that for an excellent school like Pratt, they want their artists and their students to really truly be the best that they can be. And so I don't think it matters what area or what field you go in. They are wise in their recognition of this one student excels at this so superbly, we're obligated to support them in that field. And so even at Pratt, you know, I thought I might be in children's books, I might be in pop-up books. They were like, go. Do that one thing, because if you have a passion for one thing as an artist, your chances of success are so much greater if you love it.
Hmm. You have certainly elevated the art form in unique ways, but I understand that pop-up has been around for centuries and dates back to like the 12th century. I mean, how has the art form of pop-up changed over the decades and the years?
Well, originally, pop-up books were called movable books, and they were books that just had paper moving parts within them. They were not the 3D constructions that we see today. And most of those books were educational books, but not for children. They were for adults. So most movable books, which started in about 1250, contained like discs that would spin around that were called vovels, and you could spin these paper discs, and they would tell your future, your fortune, or they would show you the astrological positions of the stars in the skies. And other books then began to show things like perspective. So books would have flaps in them. Just you'd pick up simple paper flap, or there would be anatomy books, awesome anatomy books. So you would turn a page and there would be a body standing there, and you would turn the flaps of the body and it would show the musculature and the skeleture and the nervous system. And a lot of books showed, you know, babies, because centuries ago, you couldn't dissect bodies. So a lot of these books were for students. So you could look at the book and see what the body looked like underneath these flaps, which is totally awesome. And movable books really didn't start to hit for children until the late 1700s. That flap books, turnip books, which are harlequinades, became very popular for children. But the morals were what we would expect. Be good. If you're not good, you know, you're going to be burned up or go, you know, straight down to below where you don't want to go. And only really in the mid-1800s did books start to be used as entertainment, pop-up books, entertainment really for children. And the three-dimensional pop-up books that we see today, big sculptures, those really only started in about 1929. So pretty soon will be about a century of big three-dimensional pop-up books.
So who is the audience today? I mean, I look at some of your creations. They're intricate. They're delicate. I would just be afraid to have my toddler, you know, touch that because it's so darn beautiful. Who's your audience?
Well, in the beginning, the audience was for, and I think it may sound a little bit selfish, but my audience is usually me. I really make the best pop-up books, I think, from subjects or stories that interest me. And then it's kind of a hope that will expand out to a larger audience. And I think that usually does happen because the child in me really dictates the type of work that I do. If it's exciting to me, the boy that I was when I was 8 years old, I hope that that magic will extend out to a larger audience. In terms of who actually reads my books or who gets my books, that also, to my amazement, runs a full gamut. I'll have 3 and 4 year olds at book signings who know who I am and know who the books that I've made. And I'll have, you know, 94 year olds at my book signings who also say, I have your book and your books and the magic in it is just unbelievable. So there's no longer such a segregation in children's books between picture books, chapter books, unusual books, pop-up books. I think we begin to accept the book as an object, all of us collectively. And in that sense, I'm very lucky to have that kind of audience.
Speaking with Robert Sabuda, he is a best-selling author and illustrator. He'll be speaking about his life as a paper engineer tonight, Thursday, September 27th at 7 o'clock at the Salt Lake City Main Library. That's 210 East 4th South, of course. And there will be a reception following the presentation on Level 4. We invite you to join us. If you've got questions or comments or want to share your favorite Robert Sabuda book, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. We need to take a break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. Pop-up doesn't quite describe what Robert Sabuda does. The best-selling author and illustrator's children's books are both eye-popping and mesmerizing for young and old alike. They're intricate and delicate and interactive. Today on the program, we're talking about the art and engineering behind pop-up books with Robert Sabuda. He is speaking tonight at the City Library. We'll give you more details on that as we go. But if you'd like to join our conversation, what's your favorite Sabuda creation? Or if you want tips for creating a pop-up of your own, you can give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. I think a lot of people are curious about the process, how this actually happens. I'm sure it's going to be difficult to describe, but I mean, what's the first step to creating a pop-up book?
Well, like any good book, the story comes first, the manuscript or the story. And once, whether it's fiction, nonfiction, or poetry, that's the most important thing. I have to feel inspired from that first. And then in terms of designing the book itself, you know, I don't really draw what I want the pop-ups to look like in two dimensions. I don't sketch on paper. I really have to begin working in three dimensions, and because there's no guarantee that what I draw would actually work as a pop-up. So I have to start in three dimensions. In my mind's eye, sort of a movie starts to develop. I'll think, oh, this would be a good scene for the book, or that would be a great scene, or what's the pop-up at the end? What's going to be that final moment in the movie that would be great for the end of the book? And so that little movie in my mind, I break it up into snippets and I start working in three dimensions. I just actually begin folding and cutting paper and gluing shapes and taping things on and seeing if the pop-up pops up, or most importantly, seeing if it pops shut, because the pop-up has to close over right. And over many different times. So that process can, you know, that can take weeks, that can take months, depending on how complicated the pop-up is. So I design all the pop-ups first. I finish everything in white so everything works and opens beautifully. Then I start to create the artwork that will go on the pop-ups. They have to be colored somehow. So I'll create the artwork by printmaking. I do some digital work, but every single pop-up piece has to have artwork on it, on the front and on the back. After I finished all this work, which can take 8 months, the books are sent overseas where they are hand-assembled. So all my pop-up books are actually put together by hand. Somebody folds and glues every single pop-up and every single pop-up book that has ever existed since the beginning of time. So it can take a long time, a year plus. I'm usually finished with a book a year in advance before it comes out.
What kind of paper do you use?
Well, when I'm designing, actually, people often think that I use fancy stuff. Sometimes I'll see people taking furious notes as if I have the secret, the golden secret to making pop-ups for paper engineering, but I really don't. The paper I use is really just from a regular stationery store. I get 110-pound cardstock. You can buy it in a ream of 500, and when I do workshops with kids, I just bring a big pack of 500 500 sheets of 110-pound cardstock, and they're perfect for making pop-ups, so that's what I use.
Hmm. Why do you ship it overseas?
You know, pop-up books have traditionally always been made overseas. They used to be made in South America and Colombia and Ecuador, and they had a good 20, 30-year history of making pop-up books because in South America, they were known for their handicraft. They were used to making all different kinds of handicraft there. And then that has since shifted over to Asia. So my books are made in China and in Thailand. It would actually be a lot easier if they were made here because I usually go to see my books being made, and China is very, very far away. But we don't really have a tradition of bookmaking in that kind of way here in the United States. That's just never really existed before.
Hmm. All of your creations look mind-bogglingly impossible. I mean, to me, there's no way I could make something like this. But is it hard for you? I mean, what's the most difficult part of creating a pop-up for you?
It is definitely challenging. I think I sometimes see on people's faces that they're surprised when I tell them that there are times when the pop-ups don't work. I'll go down a certain path of what I think will work, and it doesn't, and I have to set that aside and start over again. And I think kids like to hear that also. Like, sometimes it always isn't going to work out, and you'll have to, you know, learn from that experience and try to create something new or something even better than what you thought you were going to be able to do. So for me, the most difficult part is actually designing the paper constructions themselves. When I was working in picture books in a two-dimensional world, you can create anything you want. You can use any material and create any scene that you want to do. But when you're working in three dimensions, the paper lives in a world of, you know, three-dimensional physics. There are certain things that it will not do. It, no matter how much I want it to, the paper will not obey. So I have to be, you know, I have to work around that and work with that to make that kind of happen. And it can be frustrating at times. But I'd like to think that I'm at a point now where I have my bag of tricks is big enough for me to be able to design anything that I'd like.
So what's in that bag of tricks? Not just paper, not just scissors. There are some other tools in there.
There are some other tools in there. There's a lot of chocolate to get me through those through those bad brain freeze moments in there. But no, there's also a lot of sort of letting myself go. You know, at a book signing I did yesterday, I had an actual college engineer student come up to me and present to me with a paper that his department had done on pop-ups. They had sort of deconstructed the elements of how pop-ups worked in almost a mathematical way. And I was fascinated by it because I don't know anything about math. But what interested me most about what he said was, I said, oh, do you make these prototypes that you're all talking about in these papers? And he said, oh, no, I'm much too afraid. He said, I'm afraid that if I don't make it perfect the first time, it won't be good.
Oh.
And this was a young person. And so I was so glad he came. I said, listen, I make so many mistakes. You have no idea. So don't worry about that perfect prototype. Just begin and start and let the process of joy and discovery guide you. That's what I do.
Mm. Let's talk about the role of color in your work. Some of it, and one of my favorites is Dinosaurs. So detailed, so colorful. And then you've got other books that feature very simple shapes and shapes that are all white. I mean, do you have a preferred genre, or is it up to the publisher? I mean, how do you make those color decisions?
Well, really with any book, the publisher allows a lot of leeway. And for me, the artwork that I create, just like the pop-ups that I design, is truly dictated by the story itself, the book, the reason for the book existing itself. Like for something like Dinosaurs, which is a nonfiction title, there sort of needs to be color in that because there are things that are being described. These are actual animals that lived, and that book is also sort of a teaching tool. Dinosaurs is a teaching tool. For some of my whiter books that I guess are more poetic, that's not necessarily required. Simple shapes are enough to give you an indication of what it's like for an owl on a snowy winter field. So it really depends on what the story has in it and what I'm trying to convey when you finish that book. So each one is different, and I don't have a preferred technique. The book really dictates what will happen.
Mm-hmm. You said you start with the manuscript. I mean, some of your books are adaptations of stories that have already been written, mm-hmm. like Night Before Christmas and Mother Goose Rhymes. Others are original works. Do you have any preferences? I mean, do you like to do The Wizard of Oz, do you want to create something completely original?
You know, it really depends on where I guess I'm at in my artistic life. I mean, I hope that doesn't sound pretentious, but when people talk about very, very famous artists going through this period or that period or their blue period or their crazy period or whatever, believe it or not, that's really true. As an artist, I like to think that we all go through certain evolutions for unknown reasons sometimes. I know in the beginning when I was working as an illustrator, I was very rigid and very tight, and I thought that things had to be done a certain way, dictated by some unknown world. But that's not really true. And so as I'm growing older and growing older in my career, maybe I'm relaxing more. Maybe I'm thinking that things don't need to be dictated in certain ways. So, you know, there's not really a preference for it. It's just how my mood is feeling, how my artistic mood is feeling. Am I feeling like doing something completely new and crazy? Or am I feeling like I need the comfort of being at home with classic tales? So I never know what the future will hold. People think sometimes that I have like everything mapped out. Nothing's mapped out. Everything is just a crapshoot sometimes.
I'm glad to hear that someone else is flying by the seat of their pants. Yes. We're speaking with Robert Sabuda. He's a best-selling author and illustrator. He'll be speaking tonight, Thursday, September 27th at 7 o'clock at the Salt Lake City Main Library here on Library Square. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. You mentioned that you did your first project in the late 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Is technology changing your job in any way?
Well, when I first started in pop-up books, there were no, boy, this sounds old, there were no computers back in the day. Rue the computers. No, I do work on a computer now for some of the finishing work, but the three-dimensional work that I do is still done by hand today. I think we tend to think that computers are all-knowing, all-seeing, all-doing. But really the brain, the human brain, is really the most amazing computer that has ever existed, I think. And a computer could never do what my brain could do in terms of designing certain things. So I do use technology on sort of the further end of what I do when I have to make technical drawings. And I'll show all that in my PowerPoint presentation tonight here at the library. But technology has only been a useful tool in what I do. You talked about my bag of tricks. The computer is now one of the tools that's in my bag of tricks that I use to make my life easier when I'm working as an artist. But it's just that and nothing more. Everything else still needs to come from my hands to the hands of the people who are still assembling the books by hands. In many ways, it's a 500-year-old process, and it's also a 21st-century process because I do use a computer.
Hmm. As we mentioned before, I mean, there are only a couple dozen people who know how to do what you do. When you get stuck, who do you call? I mean, how do you work through that?
Who do you call? You certainly don't call the other paper engineers because they're in the same boat you're in. They don't know what they're doing either. No, you know, it's just a matter. It's funny that you say that. There are probably, maybe two dozen, maybe three dozen paper engineers on the planet who do what I do. And we all know each other. And I've met many of them before. We don't really pick up the phone and use them as a lifeline because I know they're going through their own struggles. But we definitely influence each other. And one of the things I love about children's publishing is that there is a gracious degree of influence that we all appreciate and share. And that's really true. And I think that in today's world, that's not quite the way to go. You're supposed to hold your secrets to yourself all the time. And children's publishing is not like that. And paper engineering also is not like that. The other people that I know in the field, I'll see something they've done and I'll be like, that is so beautiful. How can I let that truly inspire me to create something like that? And I'll hear the same thing from them. So it's really a small, very small community, but a wonderful give and take community.
Mm. Speaking with Robert Sabuda, he is speaking tonight at the Salt Lake City Library. And if you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number. Let's go to Peaches, who's been holding in Salt Lake City. Peaches, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to thank Robert for so many things, but most of all, he started a tradition in my family that I think it, you know, has been a wonderful tradition. We bought one of his very early books in the 80s, and I sat it on the coffee table, and I had three young children, and this was at Christmas time, and it made them pause and look at the book. And every year I would add to this collection of Christmas books. And so every year my children would always want to know what the new, latest, greatest Christmas story was going to be. And adapted reading. And then I kept them, and now my children are grown, and now I have grandchildren, and they love to come and look at those books, and it really, really entices them to not to just read. They want to know what Christmas stories are about, and we can talk about traditions, and then we can do that. And then, as my children got older, we realized the true artistic value of the book, and so that was a joy that we were able to use in science projects and just in other things. So it really, really, it just encouraged learning on such a broad basis, and I cannot thank him enough for helping us to establish the family tradition.
Thank you. Wow, that's awesome.
Peaches, were you a little hesitant to let those toddlers touch the Robert Sabuta's?
I was terrified. And you can just imagine that even now I have, because I have some of his earlier books, I am like, do I want that? I have little ones, like 3-year-olds and 2-year-olds. Do I want them touching? But the funny thing is that the older grandchildren, even though they're not much older, they're 4, 5, and 6, they understand that those books are very, very precious. So they rush right over to monitor how the book is being handled. And then the adult gets involved in the process because they want to show that younger child, how does that work? Because I'll tell her now, you can't pull without mom or dad or somebody. So then it becomes, it isn't just a person sitting down with a book. It always becomes a community project.
Peaches, thanks so much for the call. Robert, I guess that is music to your ears. That's exactly what you want.
It certainly is, yes. And that's definitely also, part of the experience of sharing books. I think that today we spend a lot of our time apart and doing our own things. And one of the great things about pop-up books, especially what Peaches had just mentioned, is that they're a shared experience. You know, it is, you then do sit down with your younger siblings or you sit down with your grandchildren and you share that moment of reading. And, you know, to me, that's so important, and it doesn't matter whether it's a pop-up book or one of my books. Those shared reading moments, you know, greatly influence an adult reader who becomes a great adult reader, and that's the greatest gift that you could give to your children, I think.
We live in the age of Kindles, Nooks. Online reading continues to grow. I mean, what's the future of pop-up look like?
Well, I think the pop-up books are going to be around for a long time, and I don't just say that off the cuff. I've asked many booksellers, you know, what's going to happen in the future? We're going through such a period of change in the industry, and they say pop-up books will always be around because there are always going to be parents or adults who want to share magical moments with children side by side with a physical book in their hands. And I believe that that is true. I think e-readers and Kindles and things have changed the way we read as adults. But as of yet, and hopefully into the future for quite some time, that hasn't occurred in children's books. People still want their child to hold the book in their hand and physically turn the page and turn back in the page to reread a word or re-understand something. And I think that's going to be around for quite some time.
Hmm. Our time is short, but finally, your website has all sorts of cutouts and patterns for, you know, kids to make pop-ups of their own. Why is, you know, sharing all of the tricks of your trade, why is that so important to you?
Well, I think, it comes back from teachers. Teachers have been such a big part of my life. My goodness, you know, teachers would come to me at events, conferences or book signings and say, I want to make pop-ups with my students or my kids, and I don't know how to do it. How can you help me? And so my website was really launched based on that reason, because so many educators were coming to me and saying, we love your books. We use them in the classroom. You know, now you have nonfiction books like Dinosaurs. How can we share the wealth, spread the news with kids? And so my website, robertsabuta.com, just my name, has patterns that everyone can go to and make their own pop-ups with their kids.
Mm. Robert Sabuta, best-selling author and illustrator. He's speaking tonight at the City Library, Thursday, September 27th, 7 o'clock in the main auditorium. And a reception will follow the presentation on Level 4 in Special Collections. Robert Sabuta, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Coming up next, the early roots of the Baha'i faith here in Utah, but first a break. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City.